said, do please join me in opening the meeting by reciting our daily prayer. God grant us the can you help me out here right at the beginning? Well, those who held up their hands as newcomers, those who were not here last week, would they hold their hands up? Oh, hell. This class is always beginning. Well, I tell you what, we tried to start here last week. First, let me point out to you that though I stand up here wearing a jacket and my hair combed and I've got this hanging around my neck, I do not speak officially for this fellowship, nor does anybody else. This is one of the incredible things about it, is that not even the founder makes any ex cathedra statements about AA. What we do is we tell you what we have come to believe through our own experience and how I would like for you to think about these sessions that we're going to have started last week, tonight, and through the rest of July. It's a kind of a workshop in sobriety. Things that we talk about that have made a great deal of sense to me and have helped me a great deal, that I glean from my own experience and experiences of others, and put them out to you for your examination. The theme that we were going to take and are going to follow, we set up last week, was the quote from the next to the last paragraph of the first section of the AA book that said, "See to it that your own house is in order, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others." This is the great fact for us. So what we set out to do last week was to see if we could make a beginning in this month, taking some pretty giant steps each week, but it gives us a whole week and a lifetime to go back and do them again and again. But if we could answer four salient questions and see if we could build a house in which not only we could live comfortably, at peace with God, with our fellow man, and above all with ourselves, but maybe a house so steady, so inviting, that we could invite others to share it. And the first question we asked last week was what I believe is the end and all of recovery from alcoholism. It has to be the foundation of this house. And that question is, what is the point of sobriety? And I'm going to quickly review that for you newcomers here tonight. And then if there are more newcomers next week, I don't know. You'll have to tell them. I'll just quickly review that one of the oldest ideas that all of us come here with, because we come with it out of our culture, is that sobriety is a virtue. And since it is a virtue, and the practice of it is virtuous, then we logically conclude that, A, we must be virtuous in order to do it, and two, if we practice a sterling virtue like that, by God, we should have a reward. And this is where we come in, and this is where all the trouble starts. Because if you're an alcoholic, this state, whether it be happy or miserable, is no longer something that you're going to decide, well, I'll do that if, and then you name your list of rewards. It has become as necessary to you as insulin is to the diabetes, for an example. And it's to quickly get across to you the point that I tried to make last week. I think I can make this more, visualize it better for you, if you would assume, instead of being an alcoholic, that you are a diabetes. You have been to a physician. He has concluded this. He has and concluded this diagnosis and tells you that you have it. And there isn't any doubt about it. That all the evidence points to the fact that you have, that you are a diabetes. And the diabetes is fatal. That it gets worse. And that if something isn't done about it, it ends in death. And you feel very depressed about this. And then he says, well, take it easy. All is not lost. This can all come to a halt. You can lead a normal life, able to do anything that any other human being can do. And all you have to do is take some insulin, either every day or so many times a week. And you say, okay, fine, I'll do that, doctor. And you go away. And after a while, you come back to the doctor and you say, I have decided not to take the insulin. Or maybe you don't even go back. Except if you are a diabetic alcoholic, you would announce it to somebody. But you go back. Let's assume you go back to the doctor and you say, doctor, I have decided not to take the insulin anymore. There's no point in taking the insulin anymore at all, doctor. And he says, why? Why, Bill? Why is it no longer any point in taking insulin? My wife doesn't love me any more than she did before. I don't get along any better with my boss. I still have these fears. I still hate people. I still hate myself. I still hate the fear. Everything is wrong. Nothing is any better. Life isn't worth living. So what's the point of taking the insulin, doctor? And that's when he says, the point of taking the insulin, Joe, is that if you want to live, you take it. I didn't, when I gave it to you, I didn't tell you that it would automatically change you into a better person. Now, if you're an alcoholic, and you have bought the idea that you're an alcoholic, and you can finally get this in your mind, to value sobriety as an end in itself, an indispensable requirement to the rest of your life. If you want to live, and you're an alcoholic, then you've passed the point when you can no longer choose about this. But you can only choose either to be drunk or to be sober. You can't choose any happy medium. That happy medium day has gone. So you've got to choose to be either drunk or sober. So, and you will decide in favor of sobriety only if and when you value being sober more than you value being drunk. Now, for our purposes, we've got to assume that you have made that decision. Because if you haven't made that decision, the rest of the weeks and the rest of the things we talk about are really, as far as you're concerned, they're just exercises in air. There's no point to them. You ought to go someplace else. Go to the ball game. Sit outside and healthy. Because there's no point. There's no point in sitting around here and brooding and turning this rigorous honesty in on yourself and coming up with all kinds of horrible answers if you have not decided that you would rather be sober than drunk. If you haven't bought this, that whether or not you're going to get any richer, any happier, any more beautiful or more handsome, whether people are going to like you better or you're going to like people, all of this is up. If you haven't decided that sobriety is an end in itself, that virtue is not connected with it at all, that all that is connected with it is staying away from the first drink. This is how you stay sober. You don't stay sober by contemplating the sunset, by doing any of these other things that I used to do, and stay drunk. You just stay away from the first drink. And you do not have to be walking with your hand in God in order to do this. What you have to do is just don't open the bottle and don't take the drink. You see, it was so strongly in my mind that sobriety was a virtue in the milieu and the background from which I came, that I had it down to a very clear alternative. If you were not in a state of grace, then the only other state to be in was a state of drunkenness. There was no middle ground. Now, I have Irish Catholic friends all over the country who are still doing this. One is in St. Petersburg, two are in New York, one is in Chicago, one is in San Francisco. They get in touch with me regularly. They still don't understand why I'm staying sober because they contend I am no better than they are. And they are right. I just value sobriety and I haven't got it mixed up any longer with the state of grace. You just don't have to do this, ladies and gentlemen. The alternative to being sober is not to being drunk, and the alternative to being sinful is not to be drunk. I said that wrong. The alternative to being virtuous is not to be drunk, and the alternative to being sinful is not to be drunk. Now, let's try, if we can take that now, to use a very overworked, but I think very apt cliche, and I think it really points it out. I think that the alcoholic, that sobriety finally has become, it's like soil to the farmer. The farmer, by God, has got to bring in a crop, or nothing happens, he goes broke. Now, he has a farm, and he has good soil. It's there. Now, he has to cultivate it. He has to let it lie fallow. He has to feed it. There has to be some rain, and finally, there is a harvest. But without the soil, without the ground, without the earth, nothing would happen. And yet, the earth of itself cannot bring forth a harvest. And this, I think, is a way you can keep this in your mind. Sobriety is the foundation of the rest of your life. The point of sobriety for an alcoholic is life itself. But it cannot of itself bring you very much more than good health and a better brain to think with. Not that they should be minimized by any sense, because they can take you far. And I'll try to amplify on that a little later. Now, if that's our foundation, then why don't we take another question tonight then? Does it logically follow? What are we doing here in AA if really all you have to do is stay sober? To stay sober is to stay away from the first drink. And this is a legitimate question. And I ask it of myself many, many times. And others have asked it of themselves, I'm sure. Because it's really, no matter, I'm shocking you with this, because until you get this in your head, you can get all confused with whether or not you're having a spiritual experience or a spiritual awakening, or whether or not you're doing it right, quote, or whether you're working the program, whether you're on the program or off the program. And next thing you know, it's all added up to, well, there's nothing else to do but to get drunk. And see, there's no reason in the world to get drunk. There's nobody so bad that he can't stay away from the first drink. And nobody's so good, no alcoholic so good, that he can't afford not to. It's as simple as that. Now, let's take our second question then, tonight. If this is the case, is a spiritual experience necessary to sobriety? I've answered it. Factually, no. And remember, I'm speaking only for myself, but I hope that you think about this a lot. Because if you can buy this, if you can take it, then your sobriety is as secure as the air that you breathe. Because it's independent of anything else. All it depends upon is simply your staying away from first thing, something as simple as that. And if you're all in here sober tonight, you are doing it, so you know it can be done. There's no doubt in your mind that it can be done. Now, if that's the case then, why would we come to meetings like this? Why would we have this book? Why would we have 12 steps? What would be the point of this whole business? Why couldn't we all just go home? It's a hot night. There's other things we could be doing. Well, first, I think, in order to follow that up, you've got to ask yourself, finally there comes a question, why did I drink? What made it necessary for me to become an alcoholic? Why was it when I found out, as we all found out somewhere along the line, that this liquid, or these pills, or whatever it was, this chemical substance that we were using, when we found out that it was doing a lot more than we bargained for, why didn't we leave it alone? Now, the answers are as numerous as the people who drank. There's a lot of them. Come down to maybe 5, 6, 7 answers. But when you put them all of these hundreds of answers, there's a few significant ones, into a Bunsen burner and distill it, come down to the essence. The reason you drank, the reason I drank, and the reason every other alcoholic drank to alcoholics, etc. was for one reason and one reason only. We wanted to change our reaction to what we thought was reality. I would say we wanted to change our reaction to reality, but you will find out, as I found out, that you really didn't even know what reality was. There was always some kind of a change to follow. We wanted to get from where we were emotionally or mentally to someplace else, and it didn't matter whether it was that we were happy, we wanted to be happier. If we were miserable, we wanted to be more miserable. We were never content to stay where we were in reality. It was move over here or move over there. A change had to be involved. If we were being peaceful, we wanted to be uproarious. If we were being uproarious, we wanted to be paralyzed. If we were in good health, we wanted to be sick. If we were in sick, we wanted to be healthy. And we always took this booze in order to change our reaction, because we found out that the reality didn't change. Our attitude toward it changed. That's what changed. So what are we going to do here in any case? Very simply, what we're going to try to do, and follow for the rest of our lives, really, is to come up with a non-chemical technique, a non-chemical substance, a any kind of outside of ingestion of any material thing. We will change our attitude and our life, our attitude toward reality, without any chemical means. This is what we're going to have to learn to do and what we try to do. Now, along those lines, let's define our terms then. What is a spiritual experience? When I came into AA, the appendix to this book had not yet been written. And what I will read to you will find out that the term spiritual experience and spiritual awakening, this was said with a great deal of awe. There were always quotes around it that really were, they quivered like papers. And you said them softly, and you said them trying not to look at anybody, and you said them always with your eyes turned up. You wanted everybody in that tree to feel that you're either there or on the verge of it, or we're having another one. Because a lot of people had them on the hour by the hour. I remember when they used to be called, the 6300 Club used to call manifestations. I mean, they did some of these. And by God, they came in there all hours of the day and night with manifestations. So the newcomer got the idea, nothing's going to work, because this is it. But just stay away from the first string. And if you never have a spiritual experience for the rest of your life, if you go on hating yourself and the whole world around you for the rest of your natural life, you can still do it sober, A lot of times you can hate a lot better sober. Think up things to do to just drive people crazy, And you don't get caught so often either. But the newcomer would get the feeling that he was going to have to wake up on a mountaintop. He was going to have to feel a clean wind sweeping through him. He was going to have to one day stand there and there would be that light. And then after that, everything would be all right. Now, it was kind of sad, too, because in those days, a lot of the people who the clean wind was sweeping through them were sweeping them out, too. They didn't hang around very long. Finally, we got on an appendix, and I want to read it to you because it will, I think, define our terms. The terms spiritual experience and spiritual awakening are used many times in this book, which, upon careful reading, shows that the personality change sufficient to bring about recovery from alcoholism has manifested itself among us in many different forms. Yet it is true that our first printing gave many readers the impression that these personality changes or religious experiences must be in the nature of sudden and spectacular upheaval. Happily for everyone, this conclusion is erroneous. In the first few chapters, a number of sudden revolutionary changes are described. though it was not our intention to create such an impression, many alcoholics have nevertheless concluded, in order to recover, they must acquire an immediate and overwhelming God consciousness, followed at once by a vast change in feeling and outlook. Among our rapidly growing membership of thousands of alcoholics like me, such transformations, though frequent, are by no means the rule. Most of our experiences are what psychologist William James calls the educational variety, because they develop slowly over a period of time. Quite often, friends of the newcomer are aware of the difference long before he is himself. He finally realizes that he has undergone a profound alteration in his reactions to life. Now, from here on in, let's use that then as our definition of the term spiritual experience or spiritual awakening. A change in your response and your attitude to life. A change, a non-chemical change in how you respond to the world around you, the people in it, and to yourself. Now, if we take that as a definition, the next question is, well, how would you go about it? And this is where the therapy of AA comes in. Where do you make a beginning? In changing permanently how you have been connected to life. The AA prayer says, God grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change. So already we must do some things we can't change. Grace to change the things we can, and the wisdom to know the difference. And this wisdom comes very quickly, because after looking back upon a lifetime of trying to change others, I think one of the first things that can be gotten across to you here is that this is pretty impossible, and that the person who's going to have to be changed is you, God. The principles set forth in AA are not new. I doubt if there's, well, maybe there's a few people that come to AA from their complete undiscovered world. I don't see how this could be, because they're as old as our civilization. They're as old as the Judeo-Christian civilization and traditions, and certainly there is in them the basic principles of every kind of spiritual approach to life. What is the new thing that AA found that it added? Probably without knowing that they had found it, but as they went along, knowing that it was the keystone. The things that probably we have never done before, that we're going to try to learn to hear, to be tied up in the phrase that you will hear over and over and over again in meetings in Southern California, but because it is contained in the preamble to Chapter 5. It says rigorous self-honesty. It wasn't too impossible for us, as practicing alcoholics and people getting ready to be alcoholics, to stand back a lot of times and size up the situation as it applied to other people and as it applied to other facts. It had been totally impossible for us to do this. We probably wouldn't have earned a living. We wouldn't have been successful at all. We wouldn't have managed at all. Somewhere back at an early age, we would have probably been institutionalized, because we would have been out of touch with reality. We would not have been able to deal with it. So however ineffectively or in a crippled manner we were dealing with it, we dealt with it to a successful, at least it kept us going. Wherein then did our handicap lie? It was when we turned this evaluation in upon ourselves. When we tried to assess our role, when we tried to look at ourselves and fit ourselves into the picture. First, this is the whole trick of what we call growing up, emotional maturity, is the acceptance of self, which finally leads to the correct evaluation of self, which would finally lead, we hope, to self-esteem. So really, the new thing that has been added in AA, not that it was entirely new, it wasn't thought of 30 years ago, the phrase self-honesty, it was that a therapy arose whereby people would apply this one to the other. That's how it began. It didn't begin in a book. It didn't begin in a great, big, huge meeting like this. It didn't begin with somebody like me standing up with a neck microphone and making with the words. It began with two frightened, terribly ashamed, terribly guilty, terribly confused, and terribly despaired and despairing human beings who got together, and because they were so frightened, so full of fear, so at the breaking point, that they began to tell the truth to each other. They told the truth to each other. And this telling of the truth from one human being to another on a man-to-man, individual-to-individual basis, without benefit of sacraments or priests or ministers, without any ritual, without any kind of dogma or doctrine, just two human beings sitting themselves naked in front of each other and therefore trusting each other, becoming willing to become totally invulnerable, becoming willing to stand there before another human being, a total stranger often, and saying, this is me. This is everything that I wish to God that I wasn't, but this is me. And I'm telling it to you, and I trust you, and I hope that you won't hurt me. This is how it began, and this is the way I think it will have to continue, because this is the way we get ready for it. To be the very epitome of the 12 principles of AA are contained in the fourth and fifth steps. Everything prior to that is preparation for those steps, and everything after it is the implementation of what we found and what we decide. Let's go back now real quickly and take the first, the second, and the third steps, if they are preparation. Nobody can work any of the AA steps for you. It's a personal experience. It goes as deep as you are willing to go. AA, like every therapy, like the patient in analysis or any other kind of psychotherapy, this is a case where the patient is always the doctor. The patient sets the pace. The patient says how far we will go, how much therapy will be applied, how well he will get. Nobody can push him because he has to do it himself. So if he is going to say, I admit that I was powerless over alcohol and that my life was unmanageable, this has to be something that easily. Now, I found that, and maybe today this is becoming more and more commonplace, that I, admitting that my life was unmanageable, it didn't bother me. I thought it was a little inaccurate because, as a matter of fact, by the time I got to AA, admitting things didn't bother me at all. I was just, you know, wanting the admitting to start bringing some results. That was all I was looking for because I had been admitting now for a long, long time. Although I held a few things back. Not sacramentally, but with you people. Because you all didn't count so much. But if, as I did, you found it was a little inaccurate to say that your life was unmanageable, then I found that if I substituted a word that was much more accurate for me, because it was what I was trying to keep hidden. And I changed it this way. Not that it made any difference to me. Not that the other was difficult. It was just easier for me. It was more accurate as far as I was concerned. I said to myself, I admit that I'm powerless over alcohol and that my emotions are unmanageable. This is what I never could really predict. I could predict that I would be at work, but I could never predict how I was going to feel. I could never predict how I was going to perform. I never could predict whether or not I would stay. So it was my emotions, how I reacted to what was going on around me, that finally became completely and totally unmanageable. So unmanageable that seemed to me the only alternative was to try to withdraw from life. And the only acceptable way to me with my religious background and belief was that I didn't do this deliberately. I realize now I did it quite unconsciously, but it was to die drunk, because there's always the chance, you see, that you will be diagnosed with something else. And as a matter of fact, that's why I always used to like to specify a sanitarium close to St. Ambrose Church on Fairfax. Because I figured if I was in the sanitarium, it was only 2 blocks away. If I'd all work out one day that the doctor arrived with a shot of formaldehyde and Father O'Toole came with the last sacrament all at the same time and all came out even, and I would be what was called safe.
That made more sense to me to say that my emotions were unmanageable. Then, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves. Nobody can take this step for you. In AA, we don't attempt to define this power. I came in with a very, very arranged God. He had been around for some centuries. He had been painted and drawn and interpreted and dogmatized, and he was down in books and every place else. And I was sure his servant, and I was scared to death. And I said I loved him, and I was everything that was going fine. And I realize now, after 16 years of sobriety and quite a little bit of therapy and work along with the years of sobriety, that I don't know anything at all about this power greater than myself. I don't know whether I understand him or not. I have a feeling if I understood him, he wouldn't be God. He and I would just be kind of buddy. He would be just Mr. Glad, I guess. Or Mr. Clean, whichever I happen to need at the time. But I don't know anything about him. I don't know anything about him at all, so I can't help you. I used to be able to give you quite a dissertation. Just mention God, and if you showed any kind of doubt, I could take you off and straighten you out. I don't know that I understand him at all. I don't understand him. I don't ever expect to, but I am content to choose to believe that if he is around, he understands me. And that should keep him occupied, as far as I'm concerned. So I'm willing to take my chances with him, and I have evidence in my life that he can restore you to sanity. However he goes about it, or whether he's involved or not, if you go along and you keep taking one more step, and you don't throw in the towel, no matter how much you want to, sooner or later, more sanity than I ever had before came, and that's quite a bit. Now, make a decision to turn your will and your life over the care of God, as you understand him. That's the thing I had been doing with deadening regularity all of my life. I did it every morning, except those mornings, of course, naturally, when I was in the state of sin. There's no use turning your life over to God. You keep it for yourself for those times. Sure as hell ain't gonna let God move in on those things, because it's only when you try to say goodbye to that life that you move over. So if you know this Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde life I had going, it was just like changing underwear. Except toward the end I got mixed up. I didn't know what suit I was wearing. But what do we mean when we say turn our will and our life over to him? If we understand, whatever our understanding is, or him or in it, what does that mean? Well, I tell you what it kind of comes to mean to me, and it didn't then, but it does now. It doesn't mean, as I used to think, that I had then, from that moment forward, had to kind of sit and wait until little celestial beep-beeps came through and said, go left, go right, get up, sit down, go to work, come home. You know, it's because things really got into a terribly static position for me for a while. I finally believe it meant that I was to use whatever gifts I had been given. I was going to have to work with the clay that I had. I, all my life, was really like a sculptor who knew he could sculpt and wanted to sculpt better than, more than anything else in the world. But he always felt that he couldn't find the right clay. If he could just find a better grade of clay, then he could sculpt something worthy of his effort and worthy of his talent and worthy of him. So he spent a lifetime looking for the clay, and finally one day he died. and there wasn't even an epitaph for him. Maybe the epitaph was, he didn't find the clay. So I finally decided that if I am going to turn my will and my life over to the care of God, and I am where I am on that particular day, in that particular situation, and in that particular state of mind, that must be where I'm going to have to begin. I'm going to have to begin where he has me now, if we're going to say that he put me there. The Catholics have a wonderful way of getting around this, because they say, you know, if you say, well, why did God let that happen? They say, well, God doesn't always will everything, but some things he permits. So, wherever I was on that particular day, I figured that's where I am, and that's where he wants me to begin. And that's where I think that any human being has to begin. Wherever he is, you can't go back and start out where you wish you could. You have to do it right where you are. The journey has to begin from where you are now. And it has to keep on beginning there. Every time there's a snag, or every time the ship founders a little bit, or gets blown off course, you have to begin again from where you are. And now this leads us, finally, to the fourth and the fifth step. There's all kinds of rules and guides, and of course it's very carefully treated in the book, and certainly in the 12 and 12 suggestions, recommendations on how to make your first inventory. There's two things that I would want to add to that. First, don't overlook writing it. It says to write it, and I didn't write it because I had been in the habit of not writing it. I mean, I had been taking inventories all my life, and my books were always so current that it never did really bother. I had to, you know, I just carried them around on my back. So the files were always in my head, always being gone through. But there is a terrific prompt that you need to put down in black and white, and try to spare yourself the euphemisms that you will want to come up with. The beautiful, sweet terms that you will want to use, instead of saying that you kick the hell out of your wife, you will want to say, you know, little marital difficulty is a nice euphemism. Don't do it that way. Put it down in black and white so you can look at it in words of one syllable. And if you say, I don't know what to do, or I don't know how to begin, begin with when you started feeling guilty. And that will be a long, long time. So give yourself a lot of paper and a lot of time, and go someplace and do this. I would suggest that if you're a newcomer, don't do this, don't try it for at least 30 days. Now, not that you need to take this advice. There's some of you who put your hog tied and kept from taking your inventory. You're looking forward to it with glee. Others will say, 5 years later, they'll say, I don't know. I just don't seem to be able to do it. But you prove it, of course, you see, that all you need to do to stay sober is just stay away from the first drink. See, I like to keep reiterating that. But why I say stay sober at least 30 days before you take 10 in hand is because for 30 days, you know, you're not sure whether you're guilty, or you're not sure whether you've been put upon. You know, you're not sure about anything. You're not sure whether you want to stay, sit, run, or fly. And if you want to put it off for a little while longer, do it. But don't put it off too long. Not that you're going to get drunk, but the only thing that will get you drunk is to take the first drink. That's what will get you drunk. So don't say that I got drunk because I didn't take my inventory, or I didn't write it, or I didn't use the right color ink. You got drunk, ladies and gentlemen, if you get drunk because you take the drink. And you decide to take a drink. No one comes and hands it to you. There's no body with a little doll image of you sticking pins in it. We've tried that in AA. We've had years of it. It doesn't work. Nobody's been able to get anybody else drunk, no matter how many little voodoo images we've made. 60 Club used to be live with them. But nobody got drunk except the people who wanted to get drunk. So don't put it off too long, but don't do it too soon. I would let 30 days go by. That's just a real time. And then you say, what am I going to put down? Well, if you started back as far as when you began feeling guilty, then doesn't it follow that you put down what makes you feel guilty? What makes you feel ashamed? What makes you feel so terribly disappointed in yourself? What makes you feel so very frightened? And if you can, if you're able to do it on the first go around, end up with those things that you would rather die than have any other human being know. Now, they always turn out to be not nearly the terrible, horrible, reprehensible things that immediately come into people's minds when you say this. They always turn out to be something that has bugged you all of your life. Sometime when you were probably terribly, terribly cowardly, or weak, or ashamed, something, keep them all in, put them there. And then, here again would be a good time to sit and think about it for a little while longer instead of rushing out to find somebody to do this with. Consider for a long, long time who you're going to take this with. The only thing it stipulates is another human being. And the only thing I would add to this is it possible in your acquaintance, whether it be a priest, a doctor, a lawyer, a psychologist, a friend, another AA member, try to choose somebody whom you feel will be able to help you look at this, neither condoning nor condemning. Because you will tend to go one way or the other in this good thing. And you've got to cut a middle road. You can either condone and you can't condemn. But one is just as important as the other. There's never enough time when you try to cover, talk about the steps, and certainly the point of this, which is the beginning of the AA therapy. But we started out tonight with the question, is a spiritual experience necessary for sobriety? I believe, and it is my opinion, that I will take to the grave based on my experience and the experience of countless others. The answer to that question is no. No. So don't try to build yourself an alibi. Staying away from the first drink has nothing to do with whether or not you are having a spiritual experience or anything else. It has to do with whether or not you, as an alcoholic, value being sober more than you value being drunk. It's as simple as that. Now then, if that's the answer to the question, then can we go on and extend the question a little bit further? If sobriety is our foundation, the indispensable foundation of the house that we're going to try to build and spend the rest of our lifetime building, is a spiritual experience necessary to raise this superstructure above ground zero? And I believe the answer to that question is yes. Now, I'll try to answer the one question that was written and turned in, and then we can spend the rest of the time if there are any questions that you'd like to ask me tonight. How does a newcomer get rid of a freeloading, practicing alkie that's living in the same house? The practicing one is paying no rent and not willing to go to AA. Help. Well, there's one great thing left out here, and that is, why is the practicing freeloading alkie living in the same house? Whether there is... I'll tell you how. The answer to that question is very simple. Nobody's going to come and take this freeloading, practicing alkie out of the house for you. This is not part of the work of AA. Although sometimes we have individual members who volunteer for such services. You will have to solve this problem by, you know, arriving at an understanding. You will either have to leave the house. Something's got to give. If this is driving you up the wall, and you are afraid that it is weakening your resolve, if you're a newcomer and this is weakening your resolve to stay away from the first drink, then you're naturally going to have to change it. But when you know none of the circumstances of the relationship, when you know, I don't know whether this person is paying, you say he's paying no rent, there's two words that work a lot of times for a lot of people. Get out. You might try it. Are there any other questions along the lines that we've been pursuing tonight? Yes. The question that Herb asked is, once you have taken the fourth and the fifth step in the manner prescribed and recommended in the book and in the principles and therapy of AA, is it necessary to do it again? I'm so glad that Herb asked this because I think this is a very, very important question. In the book, if you take this in the way the book puts it down and recommends it and prescribes it in the way we all should, you take it from a moral viewpoint. In other words, you are reviewing your life at this stage, and for a very good reason and for a very good purpose, you are viewing it from the standpoint of a moral right or a moral wrong. Then, I don't think you will ever have to do this again, because there will be no longer any need to keep going back and weighing the guilt and the shame and all of that. I spent a lifetime picking at the sores of my past, and I don't think there's anything more destructive, more corrosive than this. It doesn't get rid of the guilt. It doesn't exorcise the guilt at all. It deepens it and deepens it and deepens it. After you've done this as thoroughly as you can, at whatever stage of sobriety you are in, and you have written this, and you have taken this fifth step with another human being, then forget about it. The only other use, and you will make constant use of this for the rest of your life, the only other time now you will refer back to your past is to learn from it. And you will try to do that, hopefully, I would think, from a non-moral viewpoint. All question of right or wrong will now be left out because you have fulfilled the condition, and now you can go back and review your life to learn from it, from the pattern of behavior, what you were after, why you were doing what you were doing, and what you were hoping to gain.
Don't you think that the tenth step is more of a continuation of the fourth and fifth step?
Yes, of course, but it's supposed to be on a daily basis, and therefore it shouldn't be as traumatic as an experience as the fourth and fifth step. The tenth step really is a daily extension of the basic thing that we're talking about, the new thing that was added of rigorous self-honesty. It just keeps going along those lines. This is supposed to be a daily step. We continue to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. But as we talk, I mean, in our next session, that's one of the things I want to cover, and I'm so glad, very grateful to you for bringing that up, because this is where I think the trouble comes, a great deal of the trouble comes, is to keep going back. How many times have you people in these meetings I've been leading in the past, somebody has said to me, they raise their hand, they say, Alan, what do you do about the guilt? What do you do about the shame? What do you do about all those things? You say, well, you haven't done it. If you do the fourth and the fifth step, then the moral part of that guilt, the any of the right or wrongness of it, is you have done all that you can do. And you leave it alone. From now on, what you're going to try to build up is to build what? What was behind those things? What were you trying to do? They were not just acts that you chose out of a clear blue sky to fling in the face of God and man. You chose them without knowing it. You chose them very, very deliberately. And this is what we'll try to pursue in the next two sessions. And yet, the question is, we use the phrase rigorous self-honesty, and we assume then that therefore it's objective, it's there, and you pick it up, and you put it on, and you got it. Well, it's true. It doesn't work that way at all. because if it was that easy, we would have been practicing it all of our lives. This is why the fourth and the fifth step are the beginning. Self-honesty is, it's the way I began to try to do it with me was the only way it could come. I knew there's my act. There they were. They were in front of me. If I lost my temper, if I cut somebody down to size, if I lashed out at somebody, if I got drunk, if I slept around, all of these things, there they were. There they were. And I said, I did that. Now, that's honest. Now, where does the self-honesty come in? To me, the self-honesty means you try to understand why. Why? Because you have to be a lot thicker than we hope any of us are if you would look at this act, at the physical, actual, factual evidence of your act, and then deny them and say, no, I didn't do it. So the self-honesty to me, where the self comes in, is you look inside yourself and say, why? Why did you do this? And then you come, when these answers come up, this is the self that you have been trying to keep hidden, that you've been putting away, that you've not wanted anybody else to find out, that therefore you've kept it hidden from yourself. The self that you have repressed all these years. The self that reacted to reality, that caused it to want to drink. This is the self-honesty that you have to turn your eye into. And this comes, I think, only from a searching analysis, practice over and over again, of why. Does that answer your question?
Isn't this one of the most important reasons for sponsorship? Because even at 16 years, I'm sure that, or reasonably sure, that you probably see things about Alan that were not honest a year ago, that you thought were honest at the time. Don't you need someone outside yourself in order to find rigorous self-honesty?
I wouldn't say, I don't want to put it down to sponsorship. I think you need help. That's why we're here. So this help has to come from somebody else. I think it comes, you know, it help is all around us. It can come from, actually we're in AA because we want and we expect the help from our fellow members, the sponsor naturally. This is one of the roles he should fill. But the sponsor, I don't believe, should immediately start doing all your thinking for you. But everybody is a source of help. Doctors of any religion, I mean, I don't think you should shut out any avenue of our therapy or technique or our source that will lead to this, to make you more able to do this. Yes. It's a very important question. Thank you for reminding me to repeat these. Did you, in taking your inventory, search, no matter how futile the search, for the good in you? And I said, yes, I did, but I didn't spend much time upon it because I thought I had already concluded it was a futile search, and this was very, very wrong. This is a very good question. Again, leading again to the self-honesty. And just as you are concerned with why the guilt and why the bad and why the wrong and why the undesirable, I think you have to be equally concerned with why there is good. Why do you have the assets that you have as well as the liabilities? Yes. How do you get rid of a resentful attitude even though it may be very minor? Because minor resentments always build into big resentments. They are self-perpetuating resentments. There's only one way in the world that I have been able to get rid of resentments. I have tried praying them away. I have tried smiling them away. I have tried pretending them away. I have tried kissing them away. Nothing works for me except trying to figure out in what way the person I resent poses a threat to me. Does that make sense? In other words, what does this person threaten me with? Does this person have something that I want for myself? Does he or she in some way diminish me? Am I envious? Am I jealous? Sometimes we use this word resentment and we're not being accurate. Now, I don't think you can have a resentment against any human being unless you may dislike them. I'm not talking about this. There's bound to be people that bug you. We're talking now about people who really and truly get under your skin and are causing you to be uncomfortable. I think they always, in some case, there's some way they pose a threat to you. You are envious of them, you are jealous of them, or you are afraid of them. There's some way they have some power over you. They have more than you have of something. And they pose a threat to you. And of course, as I've said many times, one of the finest ways to watch the truth of this, with words, is if a third party can tell the resenters, let's say that you told me who you resent, and then I just say right back to you, okay, well, gee, that's odd, he speaks very well with you, and your resentment will vanish.
Yeah, 10 or 20 years, and you haven't failed at it. Now you're back, and you're trying to make it again. Do you still take this inventory?
Yes. Something was wrong the first time. So it won't hurt to review. I would review. Yes, if you've been around 30 years and you're back, I'd take the inventory again. No harm in starting from scratch. I tell you, we've run up one more question. We'll have to quit. I think you're ready to take your inventory when you would like to start changing the kind of person you are. Then you're ready. Then you're ready. Until that time, there's not much point in taking an inventory, is there? Okay. All right. I'm afraid that does it. Thank you, and I hope to see you again.